Thanks for coming. How many of you know about 500 Startups or 500 Global? How many know about 500 Emerging Europe? Before giving the floor to Bogdan, I'll just tell you a bit about it. 500 Startups is a US-based fund based in San Francisco, started in 2010. There's a portfolio of 3,000 companies all around different countries. There are 75 countries that are represented in the portfolio, and Plant & App is one of them. 500 Emerging Europe is the vehicle that's dedicated to Emerging Europe, and the way we define Emerging Europe is all the way from the Baltics, Poland, until Turkey, obviously, including Romania. We have a 70 million euro vehicle that we invest into the region. We just started. We did one deal in Poland, and we want to do more over the next 2 years. Hopefully, we're going to do a couple of investments in Romania. And our sweet spot is investing 750K all the way up till 2 million, pre-seed, seed. We do invest on idea stage. We're actually bullish on investing on idea stage. We love idea stage. So that's who we are shortly. So now I'm going to be asking a bunch of questions to Bogdan. Unfortunately, we only have one mic, so we'll be giving it back and forth, occasionally dropping it, but we'll see how that goes. So Bogdan, before we go into Plant & App, to set the context right, can you please briefly give a background about yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Enis, for inviting me to this event. So I've been an entrepreneur most of my adult life, I would say, mostly in the development space, in the product development space. I was lucky enough, so to speak, to launch my first products internationally in 2009. So that means that we got to be much bigger outside than in Romania. And that, I think, put us in a very interesting spot. And I think it's the same story with UiPath, you know, that you hear. There was a generation of startups there that started doing business internationally before there was any rules. You know, it was wild, wild west in this region of the world.
Talking of doing businesses internationally, the reason why we're doing these events all around Central Eastern Europe is a lot of the content online that you're going to find around entrepreneurship is very Americanized. If you look into different podcasts, YouTube videos, etc., it's all about US success stories. But a success story from Romania, a success story from Turkey, Bulgaria, etc., adds much more, because the problems that you would face as a Romanian entrepreneur is much more similar to an entrepreneur in Turkey than an entrepreneur in, God knows, Silicon Valley. That's why we're doing these line of events in different cities, starting with Bucharest, and then we'll do Budapest, Tallinn, Istanbul, etc. Jumping onto Plant & App, can you please describe what Plant & App does?
Sure, not an easy question. Plant & App is a no-code, low-code platform, so that doesn't say a lot to most people. But basically, we help organizations build their digital systems much faster and with less technical people. In a way, we unleash a potential of people that are the regular people, the non-professional, to build system, of course, under the governance of IT, and because you know, democratization without governance, it's called anarchy. So in a way, sometimes I think about Plant & App as a business, an HR business, about the future of work.
Plant & App transitioned from DNN Sharp back when we invested in 2019 up until 2018. For more than a decade, the company was called DNN Sharp, and they then transitioned to become Plant & App. Can you please elaborate on that transition? Why did you transition away from DNN? What were the problems there, and what opportunity you saw that made you, you know, make that move?
Sure. So I dare to say that the technology that we have 4 years ago, it was probably more mature than the multi-billion company that exists today. Unfortunately, I am a developer at heart, and my background is a development. So in the previous business, I left a lot of money on the table. You know, I was very focused on building products, which were exceptional products, and they grew organically. I didn't invest anything in sales and marketing, just throw them out there and people just buy them and then tell other people and other people would buy. But the ticket size was very slow, very low. One-time licenses, it didn't scale, and it took some time until we realized that there is a much bigger market for us, because we are selling in a very niche market. And two, that we do need other skills that we don't have, like sales and marketing, to be able to expand into this bigger market.
This was a move from on-prem license model to cloud and subscription model that wouldn't be just reliant, that wouldn't have any platform dependency, because the initial product, DNN Sharp, was dependent on DNN. Can you tell a bit about your current traction in terms of revenue, MRR, number of customers, churn, whatever you can disclose?
Sure. So right now we have over 100 customers, mostly in the US. 50% of our customers and revenue comes from the US. We inherited some of these customers in the early stages from the previous business. So in the previous business, we had around 70% in the US. So that was a very good head start. In terms of ARR, right now we are at 1.3 million ARR. We are growing steadily. We did a major pivot. I would say it started last year, but this year we formalized switching more to system integrator partnership. And it's been working beautifully for us. We are 40 people right now. Most of the development team is in Romania. The partnership team is in Romania. But we also have 7 people outside Romania. And every single one of these people are former customers, right? We try to play the game where we go to the US, we hire a salesperson or a support person by looking at a fancy CV. But, you know, Americans are very good at selling themselves. Lots of learnings. But then we realized that we already had the best people, which was our previous champions. So we still have a large pool of people to recruit on. So I guess from that perspective, and going to what you said, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And the American culture tries to inspire that, you know, that it's a one-size-fits-all. You do this and that, and that's why you succeed or don't succeed. It's about looking at who we are and capitalizing the most of what we have and mitigating what we don't have, what we lack.
So PlantNAP reached $1.3 million in ARR in 3 to 4 years ever since our investment. But what was more interesting is the cash efficiency, where the company didn't raise that much money compared to its competitors. And you guys always had very healthy unit economics, very healthy payback periods, etc. So can you please tell a bit about your current unit economics, payback periods? What's a healthy payback period in a business like yours, where you're selling a, let's say, a mid-tier subscription product into mid-tier enterprises all around the globe, but mostly to US? How do you look into these metrics?
Sure. So I think we are in the enterprise technology, so then we are seeing a very high retention rate. The stickiness is major because our platform, the customers buy it, but then they have to spend resources to do an implementation to customize it for their specific requirements. So from this perspective, we have a high stickiness. We have a 1% churn rate, so pretty low. So I think, yeah, we take a lot of pride in having raised only 1.2 million in total, and we arrive at 1.3 million in recurring revenue, right? So that's we take pride in this. But more than this, I think there's a saying: why startups fail? They don't fail because, I don't know, the idea is not a good, product is not good. They fail because they run out of money, you know. So this year it became very important for us to become cash flow positive, understanding where the world is going, and discussion with investors became much harder and much vague and more in length. So we started early, and in just 2 months we managed to be cash positive, and by quite a bit. This month probably will be 100k in profit. So that's a big difference from being 100K, burning 100K a couple of months ago.
I think this point is important as well, because what's different about Central Eastern Europe is a lot of these SaaS companies were like PlantNAP, where they would only raise $1 million or $2 million to reach to $3 to $5 million in ARR figures, which isn't something that you would see in the US. When there's unlimited resources, when there's no capital crunch, entrepreneurs just raise and raise to be able to expand. And once they reach tens of millions of dollars in ARR, then they try to think about gross margins, EBITDA, unit economics, etc. But in a place like Romania, in a place like Turkey, you always have to be 6 months away from profitability, because you never know winter is going to come, and there's always a capital crunch in these markets. But unfortunately, given the liquidity in the public markets over the past 2 to 3 years, these weren't seen as values in the US. These weren't blended into the valuations because no one cared. No one cared about your cash efficiency ratio, for example. What they cared about was growth. But now with the current state of the markets, cash became important and companies have to be profitable. And I think this is almost a competitive advantage for companies in Central Eastern Europe because the figures were already robust. So it almost makes them anti-fragile in a way, where your competitors would be struggling because they have these high burn rates to reach your current ARR figures, but you had these great unit economics from the start. But I want to go back to 2019 because Bogdan Plantanap team joined the 5Fund Startups Accelerator in San Francisco, and back then they were just doing the transition from DNN Sharp into Plantanap, and they were trying to validate the use cases, and they were piggybacking on their existing customers to see what different use cases came out of it so that they would push to replicate those use cases on other customers. But there wasn't just one. There were a lot of ad hoc use cases. People were using the product for a whole bunch of weird reasons that they have. And you guys did struggle to find a couple of use cases that you would, you know, push and double and quadruple down on. How was that use case validation process? How did you make sure that it resonated with the customers?
Sure. So, I think it was, half was research, understanding customer interviews. Half was opportunistic, based on the bigger customers that we had back then, which was a hospital building a employee assistance program. So basically giving therapy sessions to employees. And this became a use case very popular in COVID. You know, people working from home, a lot of potential mental issues. So this use case really became popular. We had some success with it, but then, of course, opportunistically, other things started coming our way. You know, so I think for us, it was always difficult to make that decision. Let's stay focused on only one use case or only one industry or things like that. And especially because opportunities would come to us from all over the place, right? So how do you make that decision? Well, we managed to turn this into a partnership program, right? Because with partners, you always would have partners that have different needs, you know? And especially nowadays, customers have different needs. You know, it's not like we buy a solution and we all use that solution. Those times are long gone. Now, so each business wants to be different, wants to be more efficient, wants to be more successful commercially, so then needs better system to serve their customers. So riding on this wave, our partners have to meet that. You know, the system integrator has to meet that. You cannot say, here's a ERP, it will take 2 years to customize it for you, and then maybe another half a year to put it live and so on. We don't live those times anymore.
And transitioning from DNN Sharp to Plantanap, initially you were trying to move those customers to become your customers on cloud, but then you tried a bunch of different sales and marketing tactics. You did inbound, outbound, content, inside sales, channel partnerships, B2B to C, etc. What have you tried? What worked? What didn't work? What's working now? What did you try and then realize that it's not working and you killed? Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. We tried everything, I think, over the past 2 years. I think, famous things that didn't work because we target enterprises and we target decision maker that's a C-level or maybe a leader, at least a second level under the C-level. So I think because of this, of course, these people would not respond to cold emails, would not see an ad and say, oh, a local platform, maybe I put it to my shopping cart, you know? So it took us some time to mature on this because yes, you hear all the things, you have lots of consultants, lots of agencies, and you hear lots of advice from all over the place, do this, do that. But in reality, us digging and doing everything, wasting a lot of money to doing everything, got us to what it's actually working, you know? So of course, B2B, is different. Enterprise B2B, it's a lot different. So then for us, it became a game of trust. You know, so for us, sales, it's about trust. How can we add trust at each stage? You know, so we see a deal closing when the customer or the partner, they trust us as a business that will continue to exist 2 years from now, very important. Will trust us as a team, you know, so how we interact, what person do we send to that meeting, you know, because if it's a junior, unknowledgeable person meeting with a technical leader, of course, that's the end of the conversation. It needs to trust the product, of course, and that's the game that we already knew how to win. We didn't know how to get people there. But also they need to trust the vision, right, because it's not a product that you are going to buy and then easily exchange with something else. We have a product that companies would buy, and they have to have the perception that it's still relevant 4 years from now, 5 years from now. You know, so I think selling the vision, especially with the technical leaders, it's important. So we got better and better at building trust at all the stages on the pipeline on all these aspects.
One of the reasons why we invested in Plant and App back then was because of the defensibility that it has with the customer. There's a good book, Hamilton Helmer, Seven Powers, where one of the defensibilities, one of the moats that you can build is the switching cost. And there's a high switching cost when you build something with Plant and App. And there's a big expansion potential. There's a big upsell potential where the customer is going to continue to build internal products and applications that would increase your average revenue per customer over the next 5 to 10 years. Let's say you reach $1 million in MRR over the next couple of years. You're currently above 100K. You grow another 10X, let's say, in the next 2 years, which is doable if you do 3X for 2 years. Where would that come from? Which sales or marketing channel would you think would thrive over the next 2 to 3 years? Is it partnerships, system integrators?
Yes, I think definitely partnerships because I think we see partners, system integrators looking, becoming very mature as well as picking vendors, you know, because yes, you pick big vendors, but big partners, big system integrators told us that we'd rather work with you because if we get the other unnamed big vendor, they will not allocate capacity for us, right? The project will take 1 year. They will not get involved. You will be there for us because we proved it. You know? So from this perspective, it became, of course, we record everything that people say. So this became part of our pitch that we have the maturity, the technology maturity of those guys, but the agility of a startup. You know? So that became like a selling point for us.
So I said the great thing was the upsell potential, defensibility, high switching cost, etc. And the bad thing about it was the hyper-competitive market, because in low-code, no-code space, you have all these unicorns or companies that are doing billions of dollars in revenue. What's worse than them is you have thousands of long-tail players like all around the place. So how do you position Plant and App in that hyper-competitive market, and what's the main differentiation that it has?
Sure. So we tried, we played this game for a long time, and also hearing from investors, oh, low-code is a crowded space, how do you differentiate, and so on. So we finally decided to invest in a Gartner subscription and downloading the research. And the first thing that we see in the research is that you cannot differentiate in the low-code market because we all say the same thing. You build faster, with less resources, less pain, everything is beautiful, right? At the marketing level, at least you cannot differentiate. You know, the key is in execution. That's what Gartner says, and that's what we see as well. So that's why I'm saying that we build the trust, because that trust people give us the chance to see how we execute on various stages, and then they see the differentiators. You know, so our main differentiators are, let's say, from the sales perspective, is the pricing. We have a pricing model that's atypical for this market. It's transparent, predictable, so that helps close the deals faster and the customers to like us because I know how much I'm going to pay for the next year. It also helps partners because partners can sell it easily, right? And also, and this is also something that we got from Gartner, pricing flexibility is also very, very important, especially as as the world changed with the COVID and everything. But I think this next period with the financial downturn that is predicted, this will also require a lot of flexibility. Then the next differentiator, what we did very well, many players in the enterprise local space, they focus on professional developers, you know? But there are no more professional developers in the world. We all want them. They are difficult to get, expensive to retain and to onboard. And we tap into what's becoming a growth engine in this world, meaning people get more and more technical skills. Regular people learn to do a bit of scripting, learn to use no-code tools, get more fancy with spreadsheets and BI tools, you know? So these are the builders in our world, you know? So a person building a complex procurement system is not a professional developer, he's what Gartner calls a business technologist, right? A business person that's mature. I call them advanced Excel users, you know? The ones that go wild with macros and formulas, those are the guys that do well with low code. Because we target those, we package our platform as no code. So everyone, including today, we had an investor call with an investor introduced by Ennis, and we did a technical demo, you know. And Yes. we did a technical demo and they were like, wow, this is so easy to use compared to unnamed big competitor of ours. You know? So we package it as no code. It appears simple, but you dig deeper and deeper and deeper and you can get to the complex stuff. We just don't throw it in your face. We don't want to scare you, right? So because we package it like this, the learning curve is much better than the competition. And we allow these people that are non-professional developers to go all the way. You know, with other platforms, you always maybe have some capabilities for the no-code people, but always if you need the complexity, you need to bring the professional developers, which also creates this kind of hierarchy. You know, those are the stupid people, we are the smart people, you know. And we heard this from customers, actually, from people using it.
Navigating in like almost a $1 trillion market, it's very tough to differentiate. So I think companies like Plant an App, they find the differentiation, they double down on that, then that window closes and then you have to refind one again. And if you do that like 2, 3, 4 times every 2 years for 8 years, you end up becoming a big company because you leveraged all of those openings. So yeah, the moment you find one, you have to start searching for your next differentiation because it can be replicated really easily. Now I want to move on to a bit into fundraising. You joined the 500 Startups program. After the program, you only had couple K in monthly recurring revenues, yet you did want to raise from US investors and they were interested in the product. Everyone loved your product and the technical skills. Did you ever feel that because you're Romanian, because the team is based in Romania, although your customers are in the US, US investors don't want to invest at early stage? And how did that change once you reached $1 million in ARR?
Sure. So I didn't feel that that the fact that I was from Romania created a problem. I remember when I started technology in 2009, 2010, I had Americans that I was talking to telling to me, oh, until I met you, I thought Eastern Europe is just a place where hackers come from, you know. But in the meantime, I think perception changed a lot, you know, because Silicon Valley is full of Romanian developers, right? So I didn't feel like I have a handicap on that side, on the nationality side, but I did feel I had a handicap on the cultural side, on the sales training side, you know, because in talking to investors, or at least how it appeared to me in the US, it was a sales game, right? A numbers game and a sales game, you know? So that's where I felt that I'm underperforming. And I wouldn't say that I'm much better now, but I am much more confident after having hundreds of conversations with investors.
Companies get acquired for a bunch of reasons, but just to map them a bit, and obviously I'm going to ask you a question on acquisition. On very low acquisitions, companies can be acquired for their team. If you go down to the second tranche, it would be team plus product. So you want to buy the product, but also buy the team that's going to continue building on top of it. I guess the third one would be more expansion. This can be market expansion, segment expansion, geographic expansion, etc., where the multiples are higher. And then the fourth category are existential threats, where you either buy this company or this company can actually kill you. And then the multiples are obviously off the roof. That's where you hear like $1 billion exits in the market with like 50x plus multiples, etc. Coming to Plant an App, if there's an acquisition down the line, 2, 3, 5, 10 years from now, who do you think are the likely buyers? You don't have to name names, but if you can give product categories or company categories, that'd be great.
Sure. So I think one, other low-code platforms, because we are in this what I call the citizen developer game. Most of the low-code platforms are in the professional developers game, and I think for them it's a ticking clock, you know, because that workforce is not growing as fast as the demand. So I think that's, let's say, the first suspects. The second suspects, I think, complementary technologies like RPA. It's a very good example, and I see a lot of RPA companies trying to do low code. I would say that the third tier would be a major SaaS company, enterprise SaaS company that need to add low code capabilities to their platform. And I'm constantly approached by these kind of companies, you know. Like, for example, you have a big financial system that you sell to enterprises, but of course, people in the company or system integrators cannot customize it easily, build a workflow, some customization on it. So then that's what the market started demanding, you know. Okay, give us the off-the-shelf software, but give us the power to do anything we want with it.
I like the phrase citizen developer. One of the things that I forgot now that you said it, I remembered, was that we're not targeting professional developers, we're targeting citizen developers, and the number of professional developers can't increase that much. There's a cap, there's an education cap that's put onto it, but citizen developers, it's actually booming, and that's a new type of developer category. Was one of the things that Bogdan said 3-4 years ago that kind of caught my attention, and still the case on your pitch deck with the citizen developer. Thanks a lot for joining. It was a pleasure to have you here.
To stay in the loop, go to our website, getcc.com, or follow us at getcc on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube.